So I would like to begin with an expression of gratitude for all of us. It's really quite extraordinary that wherever we've been, whatever we've done, that has brought us here together at this moment. Imagine all of the intention and all of the planning and all of the grace that has brought us here together this weekend. I especially would like to thank the Cleary and the Golden Sufi helpers for arranging this event, and for Llewellyn Von Lee, who for many years has held the inspiration in the container to hold these events. It really is a great honor to be here with all of you. And I imagine you feel the same. I hope that you do. So this afternoon, I'd like to take you on a little journey with me. I'd like to share a little of a recent journey in my life on the Sufi path. And as I today have been anticipating this talk, I have found myself quite emotional. So please forgive me there. I don't know quite how this will unfold, but there's some very deep experiences that I would like to share with you. And I ask you to listen with your hearts. I think you probably all know how to do this. So if you can just relax, as I will also hope to do, and journey with me. So this time in my life began a few years ago. I was placed in a situation I had not anticipated. And I was to lead a retreat with a colleague who was flying out from California to join me. But it was September 15th, 2001, and as you might recall, no one was flying anywhere. So I was here at this retreat with about 25 people, really quite unprepared, as I had anticipated my colleague, and also quite unprepared because everyone was in such a state of shock. And the first evening of the retreat, I went to my room and I prayed and prayed and prayed. I said, well, I really don't know what to do here. You know, God, you've put me here. You're going to have to help. And that night I had a dream of a sheikh, a very vivid and very intimate meeting. And I was given something in my body, actually given something. And I knew it was very important, and but I didn't really want to quite live what I had. I mean, I led the retreat, but I knew that the dream was larger than the retreat and that the experience was speaking to something if I was willing to step forward into that. I knew who the sheikh was. I had heard of him. And I didn't think it had anything to do with me. Maybe it had to do with my husband who was working with him. Maybe it had to do with other people, but not me. But as things unfolded in the next 6 months, I was invited to accompany my husband. I was invited myself to travel to Morocco, where the sheikh lives, and to attend a gathering, a celebration. And for many months I said I wasn't going to go. but I finally agreed that yes, I would go. And we flew overnight to Morocco with a small group of Americans. We got on the train and traveled from Casablanca, several hours through the countryside, very beautiful countryside, over the mountains, and as we're coming into the city of Fez, something happened in my heart, and I was thrown into a very deep state. I would call it now maybe bewilderment. I mean, what it felt like was I was in tears inside. I didn't want to show those tears. I just tried to keep them to myself, but I was quite overcome. This state lasted for actually several days. We were taken to the house of our host in Fez. And something in me just cried and cried and cried for days, quite inarticulate. Now, this is a woman who has been involved in the Sufi tradition for more than 30 years at this point. Someone who thought perhaps she knew something or had some understanding of maybe what the path is about. And here, I mean, it was quite shocking, really, quite shocking. Fortunately, our host is also a guide. He's also a representative of our sheikh, and he's working with me during this time. So I have a little bit of understanding, not much. Basically, he says to me, just rest. Everyone else in our party, he's giving all these assignments to. Do this, more of this, more of this, more dhikr, more this, more that. To me, he just says, just rest. And of course, I think, oh, that means there's something wrong with me. I don't deserve to get all these assignments. I'm just, you know, and I, you know, so these are all just the stories that take place in one's mind, you know, just the talk. So this is a very special celebration that takes place in many parts still of the Islamic world. And it's the celebration of the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad. And we are going to the center, the main center of the sheikh for this event. And as we arrive, the other women I'm traveling with and I go in one direction, and the men go in another direction. And the three of us have never been here before. And we are given very brief instructions. Very, very brief. Just don't talk, do your dhikr. What we were told. And we walk into a gathering of thousands and thousands of women, all here for one purpose. That first visit was pretty much a blur. I can't say too much more. It was quite overwhelming. But I returned, so I can say a little more, describe it a little more. But that really, that first visit, I really couldn't speak. I could hardly move. My friends had to take my hands and kind of lead me from place to place. And this is not an American gathering. This is in a very different culture, in a building that somehow has been built over time, where, you know, none of the halls are straight, and the doorways show unexpectedly, and you go from a hallway to a court. It's very, very easy to get lost. But you really couldn't get lost because there is this much space between you and everyone else. So when it's time to go into the masjid for the evening program, everyone is heading in the same direction. I learned there was a little bit of an advantage because I was a head taller. I could actually see. But it was, we were just, there was, their sense of personal space is quite different. So we're all sitting very, very closely together in this large, large room. And I don't understand any of the words. Nothing's done in English. It's all done in Arabic. But I hear the music. I hear the singing. And something in my heart is so happy. The beauty and the devotion that I see in these women is something I've never experienced before. And there's groups of young women. It was explained to me somewhere along the way that these young women from the different cities and villages have been learning these traditional songs. And they get together every week and learn these songs that are all songs in celebration of the Prophet Muhammad, their love and devotion for this prophet and for the message that he brought is so evident in their voices. And so they've learned these songs all year, and then group after group, sort of spontaneously, this is, I was told there were 10,000 women there, I could imagine that, in a space that would accommodate about 3,000 in America. Voices would rise, like a group would start singing in one spot, and then another group would start singing somewhere else, and just the songs went on for hours and hours and hours. So at about 4 a.m, we left. And we came back to America. And a great desire was being created in my heart to go back and to actually meet this very great sheikh. A great longing to see him, to be in his presence. So I returned the next year, just almost 12 months later. I traveled by myself, but was met immediately. When I go to Morocco, I'm always taken care of by Sufis. I mean, I get permission in advance, and then arrangements are always made. Because I become quite helpless. I mean, it's very interesting to be a capable, competent woman of the world in America, and for this person to step into a culture where I am completely helpless. I'm like a baby. I know no I do not know the languages that are spoken there. I've had to learn by observation the adab, the culture, the way of being. And it's not just the way of being in a different culture, but it's actually the way of being within this tariqa, among these lovers of God, who have been so beautifully educated that any mistake that I would make, I wouldn't even be made aware of. They would just hide my mistakes from myself. But I knew that, so I was always very anxious, you know, to not make a mistake. But I didn't know what the mistakes were. It was actually very difficult. So this second visit, again, I go, I stay with Sufis. I'm taken, by the way, where we go in Morocco to the Zawiya, to the gathering place, is all the way across the country from where we arrive. So it's quite a journey. I mean, it takes quite a bit of time. It's quite arduous, actually. And acclimating and so on. It takes several days for us to adjust and get there. So anyway, I'm taken, and again, this time I'm taken by a friend from America who's Moroccan, who's a man. And once we get to the gathering, I'm alone. I'm by myself. I don't even have other Americans to speak with because the men are elsewhere and I'm just with the women. So this time I have a little more capacity. And I remember, oh, just relax. And I can find where to go, and where to sit, and where to wait. And as I did this, of course, then someone I had met the year before would arrive, remember me, take me by the hand, take me to the sheikh's daughter. I mean, it was just, and every time I got frightened or contracted or, what am I doing here? What do I do now? Then that would all sort of go away. So it was this training that was going on just constantly to just relax in this sea of beautiful faces. Everyone's wearing their best clothes and their most beautiful headscarves. So it's it becomes an ocean of beauty, of wearing your best to be in the presence of the beloved. At one point in the Layla, the celebration happens after sunset, after Maghrib prayer, and I'm there in the afternoon and I'm told, you know, it's going to be too crowded in there tonight, so you just wait here, you know. And I'm thinking, yeah, right, like I'm going to miss it. So it happened that I was left alone and it was time to go, so I just got up and went by myself. And it's really, and when I walked in, the room is already full. I mean, it's already absolutely full. And there's this little path, it's like a little rivulet, a little stream this wide that winds through this room eight times the size of this room here. And I follow this path, very careful not to step on, and there's a stream of women, you know, walking one by one along this path. Well, the path goes out of the room. I mean, there's no place to sit, so I followed this path into the room and it leads out, so I refuse to leave. So I'm standing in the doorway. And this woman who's sitting right next to the doorway looks at me. She says something, really quite stern, you know. And I looked at her and I said, I'm sorry, I don't understand. I don't speak the language. She looked at me, she grabbed me, and she gave me the best seat in the whole house, right next to her. She recognized that I was, you know, not of that place, that I was a guest. And I don't know what was said among the women around me, but they were feeding me. They were making room for me in a situation that was impossible to make room for anyone. I think I did have a little more room probably than anyone else. But it did, it, you know, it was quite crowded. And when it was time to do the evening prayers, they were so happy to see that I could pray with them, that I knew the same words that they knew. And I felt so strange. I felt like I was being so welcomed that actually I did belong there, even though it made absolutely no sense to my mind. By the way, this goes on all night. So there's no sleeping. I mean, some people sleep, and many people leave at about 4 a.m. Buses, there's buses coming from all over the country. But I've agreed to meet my ride, my companion, at 9:00. It's time for me to go. And I find that I don't want to leave. And as I go out the door that I've been traveling up and down all night, this one iron grate, the door had been open all night, and I come down and the door is locked and I can't get out. And now I really start crying and I have to go up and around and try to remember all the way back around to come out to meet my companion at 9 a.m., which is our agreed upon. And I can see him out the window. I can look down past the courtyard and see his car, but it was very difficult to find my way back to him, and by the time I get to him, I can't even talk, and I just keep saying, I don't want to leave, I don't want to leave. And he says, well, just relax. Just sit here. He puts me in the car. And once again, arrangements are made. And an hour later, he says, "How, you know, you have enough money for the train?" He said, "We're taking you to, someone else is taking you to the Sheikh's home. And you can come back in a few days. You have my phone number. You know, I have to travel across country. I'll talk to you in a few days." I'm taken to the Sheikh's home. And he's not able to see me. He's not seeing anyone. He's not well. This is one of the first times that he has not come to the gathering, he's not been well. I sit in his home for about 12 hours. We learn the Sheikh's not seeing anyone. There were some other people for him to see. I was to join. And I am gathered up by this group of young men who put me on the train and escort me back to my companion, and I come back to America. But this longing to see the Sheikh doesn't go away. If anything, it just gets worse. It's very, a very painful condition. I'm finding more and more that I have been placed in this state where it's very, very difficult. It's difficult to speak about. It's as though I'm not allowed anything. There must be something really seriously wrong with me, because I don't belong here, and I'm not being allowed. I'll never see the Sheikh. I'll never have a living Sheikh in this lifetime. I've certainly had a Sheikh, but he was not embodied. But I will never have this opportunity. This will never happen for me. And it's, you know, it's because there's something really wrong with me. I mean, really deeply wrong. This was the state that I was living in for really, I think it was about 2 years. And again, I mean, certainly not what I had expected when I signed up many, many years ago for this journey. So I went back again. I had some other reasons to go back to Morocco the following year. Yeah. And took care of those reasons. And I'm still asking, can I see the Sheikh? And I'm told, here, do this retreat. So I'm staying at my friend's home, and I'm spending the day in silence, and I'm repeating dhikr silently, which is what we do in this tradition, la ilaha illallah, silently, and some other prayers that I do, and the salat, all day long, all day long, all day long, day after day. Maybe I take a little walk in the afternoon. And something in me is getting ground down and ground down. At first, it's wonderful, but then something in me starts getting ground down and ground down. And finally, on the third night, I just hit such a place of despair. I packed my bag. I reviewed in my mind a million times what I was going to say to my host. Just take me to the hotel, and I will wait there for my plane back to America. I don't belong here. I don't know what I was thinking. Why would I ever think that I could meet the Sheikh? What am I doing here? This is crazy. And it's really just I'm sorry. I've imposed myself on you. You've been so gracious, but just take me away. So I mean all night I was rehearsing this conversation, which then I had out loud to my host, who was a Sufi. Took a few breaths and said, what can I do to make your stay more comfortable? Is there anything I can do? And that was the day that the arrangements were made for me to go see the Sheikh. It just happened to be that a young man that I knew in America, a Moroccan-American, was in Rabat at the same time I was. He needed to see the Sheikh, so he was asked to accompany me. So we take an overnight train ride and are picked up in the morning, and with the Sufi who's the taxi driver, we're driven out into the desert another hour. It's just very, and we had no sleep. The train was very crowded. And Simo says, goodbye. See you back in America. And once again, I am on my own. And I walk into, and I'm told, oh, this is where the women live, over here. You know, go on this side. And again, I have to find my own way purely by sense. It turns out everyone's asleep. In this tradition, everyone stays up until Fajr, which is dawn, before dawn. Everyone goes to sleep at dawn. It's 9 o'clock in the morning, everyone's asleep. I pass a room with a pile of women asleep. I walk through the kitchen. I'm standing in the hallway. I don't know which way do I turn? Which way do I go? Oh, over here, okay. So I lived in a room about the size of this with kind of padded benches all along the sides where I slept at night. And this is where the meals were served for the women during the day. This is where the sheikh's wife comes and takes her meals. And the sheikh's daughter, who is about my age, who runs the home. And any visitors who come, visitors kind of come and go. And for 3 days, I sit and wait. And again, I'm just reciting my dhikr, speaking a few words of French, doing a lot of sign language. Everything that I can imagine I need shows up. Food, beautiful food, so lovingly prepared by the women. And the first day I'm there, I'm told that I will see the sheikh. And I'm staying in a room. This room has a grill. It's very almost like medieval, this ironwork on the windows. It looks out into a courtyard. We're in the desert, but we're actually in an oasis that's been created in the desert. And there's rows of bushes and a fountain. I can hear the fountain all day. And of course, the birds have all come here because there's trees and shrubbery, and there's nothing around that. It's all desert around it. So it's very, very melodious, hearing the birds. And at sunset, I'm told, they raise the curtain and turn out the lights so that I can see my first glimpse of Sidi Hamza, the sheikh. He's going to be taking a walk. And so here he comes. And walking by his side, just a half step behind, are two of his companions, walking in perfect step with him. So I see his profile. He's, you know, I knew this man was very ill, he's very old, and I'm seeing this vigorous, very large, vigorous man. And really, all I see is light, just so much light as he's walking with these two companions. And one of my concerns was, of course, there was no one at the Zawiya who spoke English. And as I look here, I see someone I had met in Washington, D.C., as one of his companions walking with him. He's from Oman, who speaks English. And I realize, of course, I'm going to be completely taken care of. If I need anything, I can get a message to him. And 3 days later, the night before I left, arrangements were made, and this companion who spoke English was waiting for me and took me in to meet Sidi Hamza. I had so many thoughts about what I should and shouldn't do, what he would and wouldn't do. What was the appropriate way of behaving? How was I going to be? Why would he even want to see me to begin with? All these thoughts had just been sort of churning and churning and churning. And in his presence, everything left, except his complete welcome. Such a beautiful, deep, loving welcome. All of my not being good enough was seen. All of my defects, all of my fears were just melted in his presence, embraced, if you will. And we sat there in the courtyard looking out at, as the sun was setting, so the light was changing, the sun was behind, so we're facing Mecca. The roses, the light changing, the mountains of Algeria in the distance. He's speaking with me, it's being translated. And I feel as though it's difficult, I would never be able to really fully describe the moment, the experience of the moment, but it was as though creation was coming into existence in this moment, in his presence. and at the same time that this incredible power, unbelievable power is here, there's such tenderness, there's such present kindness towards this person, nobody. I just remembered, at this point I hadn't slept for days. And I'm leaving in the morning, arrangements have been made. The cab is arriving at 9 o'clock. Really, the cab driver doesn't speak English. I mean, no one speaks English. And I go back to this large room that I've described, and it's the weekend, and all these women have arrived, and they're all sitting up, and they're talking, like, all night. All right, you know, and loud, not quietly. And I have another one of what I call my meltdowns. I jump up at one point. I mean, I'm just so raw at this point. No sleep. Just this extraordinary experience that I can't even comprehend has taken place. And I have to somehow get on a train and journey, 10 hours and get off the train and get a cab and get to my, you know, so you can imagine. So I jump up and start shouting in English. And Lala Asiya, the Sheikh's daughter, takes me and lays me down and puts the blanket over me, and you know, like I'm a baby, and I was. And you know, and they talk very quietly for about 3 minutes. And then they're back talking like this really animated, and I just, you know, something in me just gave up completely. Just gave up completely. By the time the taxi arrived at 9 o'clock, I realized I was getting sick. And I had to explain to the cab driver that instead of getting on the train, he had to take me to the hotel next to the train, check me into the hotel, that I was not able to travel. So I spent the next 24 hours locked in a hotel room, not knowing if it was day or night, with 2 large bottles of filtered water. And I was fine the next day to travel. So that was a bit of the journey that I wanted to share with you. But I also wanted to talk about some of the qualities or the characteristics, the attributes that I've experienced in this community around the Sheikh. And I'd like to start by reading something attributed to Abdul Qadir al-Jilani, one of the great Sufis. My brothers and sisters, I did not arrive at union with Allah by staying awake all night in worship, by staying aware all day in fasting, or by staying engrossed learning knowledge. Rather, I arrived at union with Allah by generosity and humility and letting my breast be at peace. Generosity. My husband and I have never experienced the outpouring of generosity that we experience when we go to Morocco and stay with the Sufis there, and when we journey to the Zawiyas, to the centers, especially there. Whatever we even think of seems to be presented, not only to us, but to everyone there. Perhaps some of you have experienced this in travels in special parts of the world. Someone will come to you. A woman, she had a bracelet on, and she had another bracelet in her purse, and she said, "You see these 2 bracelets? Which one do you think is the most beautiful?" Watch out for that question. So the next thing you know, whichever one you say, I mean, you can't say they're not beautiful, right? She's showing you, and of course, you know, then you're given the bracelet. Even children were giving me gifts. And they weren't like gifts that they went and bought. It was something of their own. A little girl, Fatima, the niece of one of my friends, gave me a beautiful necklace her father had given her. Out of friendship, I didn't want to take it. Her mother said it was okay. But it was really quite, we have no idea of this kind of generosity. I have never experienced, perhaps you have, this kind of generosity. A hallmark of a Sufi generosity. Now, we've had retreats in our home. I was remembering we had a rather large retreat, about 40 people in our home, and I had it catered. And the big meal was in the middle of the day. It was a lovely meal with fish and lots of food. And it was all laid out. So 40 hungry Sufis, no one would eat. No one would start. I finally had to go to the sheikh who was leading the retreat. And I said, please, Sidi, you have to come and have some food because no one will start. Everyone wants to wait for everyone else to begin. And this is not an exception. This is what we experience every gathering, every day. Every day in Morocco, in our gatherings here, this is the adab, this is the attitude, the generosity. Humility. This is from Ibn Atta'Allah. His commentary is 12th century, another one of the great Sufis. This is a commentary on the signs of success on the spiritual path, written by Abu Madian. Then Abu Madian says that the Sufis are exalted by giving preference to others. It is their nature. They never cease to give preference to others without their deserving it. Giving preference to others without their deserving it. So certainly a part of the inner work that I had to go through that I hinted at a little bit or spoke directly to is that sense of not deserving. And that what is given anyway. Despite that, it's not my effort. It's not mine. It's not that I did something right. Maybe I did something wrong. Maybe I'm in more need than someone else for this love and generosity. I don't know. But it's not that I deserved. But to give the opportunity for someone else to express their generosity. So this is an example of the adab. There's another quality that I was unaware of in my own experience of Sufism, and it speaks to a limitation in myself, but perhaps a limitation in what has been known here in this country about Sufism. And that has to do with a kind of inner striving, a kind of inner effort. And I could only speak about it when I found the absence of it in myself. And the best way that I can describe it in simple terms is an inner relaxation, an inner condition of helplessness, an inner condition of reliance on something other than my own effort. And again, you are looking at a woman who has been very accomplished in traditional ways in American life. You know, successful businesswoman, well-educated, a family, you know, a family homeowner. I mean, many, many things that we take for granted that you have to work very hard for, you know, and you set your intention and you work hard and you, well, I somehow had also applied this same attitude of, this is what I want, this is what I'm going to get. And I had taken this into the spiritual path. And it had really kept me from a realization that's much greater than anything I could have imagined, the experience of life, much greater. So when Abdul-Qadir Jilani says, and letting my breast be at peace, I understand that to be a state of inner rest, of inner allowing. And, you know, with all of these things, that's 24/7. It's certainly the aspiration. Not just when I go to Morocco. So before I talk a little about my life, I wanted to answer the question, and I'm still answering that for myself. It's the so what? So what? You know? So you told this great story, so what? You know, it could have been an imagination story, but what does it mean? I'd like to share something of our tradition. We have a group practice that we do I felt would be not appropriate for us to do in this case. I mean, it would just be very difficult. It's all in Arabic, and unless you know a little bit, it's hard to do. So we do this recitation, a dhikr recitation, and then there is singing, sama. And I want to read a little bit about this sama, and then we'll listen to a little bit of it. Here's some of the things that are said about the sama. By the way, these words and melodies, many of them are very, very, very old. Very old. I mean, they go back to the time of the Prophet Muhammad and before. And they're still being carried forward. And then some are inspirations that are new. So there's both. The sama is a means for remembrance and can produce a state of spiritual nostalgia. Sama softens hardened hearts, awakens souls from sleep, and ignites a desire for the spiritual world. It's said that we have all heard this music in paradise, and that it can help enter into the state of love and peace promised by the divine message. These are songs of devotion, always of devotion. Usually, as far as I know, songs in praise and in asking for blessings for the Prophet Muhammad. This is an injunction in the Quran. You know, pray for the peace and blessings upon the Prophet Muhammad. And the one I'm going to read a translation of what we're going to listen to. The first part is speaking, the beloved is the Prophet Muhammad. And the second part is speaking directly to him. In this spring, when the beloved was born, Allah's generosity for the whole universe has reached its apogee. And through him, Allah has guided us to the straight path through the trustworthy one, Taha. Welcome. Welcome, O you, the rescuer of the unworthy ones. You were sent to us as a protection and a shield. O you, the last of the messengers. Yes, indeed, on you Allah prayed all the time and on every moment and on all your family and companions.
Thank you.
So, dear ones, thank you for taking this, for sharing this journey. And when I think about what to say next, there's not much to say. To be in life, to be living in life, being given a drink of love, to be here, knowing something that's not of this world and yet so deeply embedded into every fiber and cell and molecule and breath and hair. And you've heard many talks, beautiful talk this morning. I especially resonated at the moment of Mary pregnant with Jesus and Elizabeth pregnant with John, with Yahya. And how that reminds me of the experience of being with Sufis, where that yes bows down in me to you. That yes, that recognition of love, of oneness. Meets and it doesn't just happen here, it happens in life. It happens in washing the dishes, talking on the telephone with my clients, my business clients. In the classroom, when I'm struggling to convey a concept to immigrants who are struggling to learn English, with my 2-year-old granddaughter, when we're playing on the swing, that's the easy part. You know, when I've had a long day and I'm grumpy and I come home to greet my husband. So in a way, this is the real story. Also, and that was a realization I had when I came back. After I met the Sheikh, I came back. My life had been completely changed just before that meeting. The work I'd been doing for 13 years had been taken away. I went to Morocco. I came back to a new job, started a new job the week after I came back from meeting Sidi Hamza. I was offered, a few weeks later, I was offered the teaching job that I also do. And as I was preparing to kind of like, I don't know if you've been on retreats where you come back into life and you feel this kind of like, I've been somewhere else and it's difficult to be here. Okay, I was in that state. We live out in the country and it's this autumn and it was a beautiful fall day and I was taking a walk and I was having this conversation with myself. It went something like this. Okay, you know, you've just been given so much, so this incredible experiences. All right, but that's over with. That's done. You know, now just get on with. And in that moment, as I'm saying, that's over with, as though I were trying to close a door on something that I thought was other, I was told in no uncertain terms, no. This is your life. This the extraordinariness of life itself is open and present and calling for this love and calling for this mercy and compassion to be lived. Now, this is it. This is your life. This is the rest of your life, if you choose. So it was one more moment where I had the opportunity to say yes instead of no. For me, those opportunities keep coming where there's a choice to say yes or no. And that was one of those moments where I said yes again to a new life or the same life but seen with new eyes. And so I really don't have anything else to say about now. And I'd like to welcome your questions or your comments or your experiences. We have a little bit of time. Right? Yeah. So. And, you know, you've listened so beautifully. Thank you. You've really welcomed me. Or this. So please, if someone has a question or a comment.
Where is this?
Please. I'd like to know where the Zoe is located near Algeria, near the border.
Right. The term Zawiya, of course, means center, okay? And the main Zawiya is outside of Oujda, and actually outside of Berkane. It's in a beautiful agricultural valley. Sheikh Hamza's family are farmers, near the Mediterranean, but actually surrounded by mountains.
So you're right on the border of Algeria?
Very close to the border of Algeria, yes.
That was not a difficulty?
You know, I've been learning that I make a request and then I wait, and permission's either given or it isn't. And I mean outwardly as well as inwardly. And it's not like anybody seemed to know the answer. Everyone would, the Sufis ask, check it out, okay, yes, no, but you know, that, you know, we have been very taken care of. We've been protected, but we've also had permission. We've also been taken.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Answer your question, yeah. I remember you've been in Morocco many times and love it there, yes. Someone else? You've all fallen asleep? I've always felt that I do much better with a talk if someone has a question, you know, because then they can speak to something. Coming up with something to talk about is not my forte. Thank you. For better or worse, thank you.
First I'll start with Jelani in Santa Cruz sends her greetings to you.
Thank you. And to her.
Okay. Yeah. And so I'm curious, I don't know, maybe I missed it or so, but so you said you were on the Sufi path for over 30 years before you had the dream with the Sheikh and such. So how would you describe, like, the main change, the before and the after, and what really unfolded? I know this was like a turning point, it seemed like. Mm. And it sounds like perhaps your Sufi experience became deeper by meeting the Sheikh. Could you explain that a little bit more? Or maybe you did and I missed it? Or
Thank you. Thank you for your question. Hazrat Inayat Khan, Pirzia's grandfather, spoke about the importance of having an image of God, to have some, you know, to have something. What is God? Okay, to have an image of God that then is shattered, and then again, a new understanding, a new way of viewing is created, and then that is shattered again and again and again. So perhaps that's a way to speak to that. I also was trying to talk about it at that moment in the apple orchard when I returned, and realizing that something had been given that changed everything, and that my own planning and scheming and trying to set certain things in place to make my life a certain way was not only unnecessary, but a great limitation.
Could you give us some concrete examples of how your outer life changed then by the experience of going to Morocco in the respect that you said humility and generosity and peace of heart?
Okay. Thank you. Examples. The job that I was offered quite unexpectedly the week before I left for Morocco, and I actually didn't accept the job until I was in Morocco because I didn't know if it was the right thing for me. I actually had been offered a job in Morocco teaching English, and so here I had this job offer in America that came quite unexpected, and I was unemployed for a few months. I was enjoying the first time in forever of just not having to work for a while. And so while I was in Morocco, I made the decision to come back, which my husband is grateful that I made, and to accept the job in America. Well, that job has turned out to be such a good a fit for me. I mean, it was really quite unexpected, and it has been very suitable for me, and it has allowed my family to be very generous, actually, in what we can offer to others. So that was quite unexpected. One of the delights of my life now is teaching, working with immigrants, mostly refugees. I got a phone call 2 months after I'd been back in America saying, "We hear you're back. We have an opening. Would you like to teach a class for us at the school where in Charlottesville?" So one or two nights a week, I work with people from all over the world and learn from them and share with them getting around in America. And it's very creative and delightful work for me. And I think for them too. I mean, we have a lot of fun. And that was not something I went looking for. I just arrived. I had a very serious medical diagnosis, quite unexpectedly. It was discovered miraculously about a year after it's something that one dies of if it's not discovered. And it was discovered accidentally and completely repaired with surgery. And I'm completely whole. And in my defects. That was quite a shocking experience, another opportunity where I had to say yes to a very frightening experience as someone who's been very healthy and never had any kind of medical difficulties at all. I just use that as it was rather dramatic, but it could have been there are many simple examples. The simple examples sound so simple that I don't know that they would be interesting.
But so when your inner eyes open, so you now could see more ways to practice. Or was it an attitude change?
So she says, were my inner eyes more open so that I could see more ways to practice? I wouldn't describe it that way. It's something that's lived. It's not, well, perhaps I can answer it in another way. So how do I keep the connection going? Maybe that's a better way to answer it. Yeah. So this is what we do. I mean, every sheikh has a method. Every sheikh has a method. Our sheikh has a method, and I follow the method. I spend maybe 45 minutes, an hour a day. We have a group privately. We have a group practice that we do. And I just do it. And if I don't, things start getting a little funky really quickly. You know, within a day or two or three, things get a little edgy, and it's just, you know, stick with the method. Yeah. The method is given to women and men. It's the same method. Little, you know, there's tweaks, you know, and maybe there's slightly different prescriptions for each person, from what I understand, from what I've learned over the years. But we all have the method. And we just do it. There's a couple questions. When was I last in Morocco? A year ago, April, I was back from Aulid. This is my third visit to the celebration at the Zawi in Berkan. I brought a couple of women with me who had not been to the Zawiya. One of them had been with me to the Sheikh's home, but not to the Zawiya. It's really quite an extraordinary experience for Americans. And it's very difficult. I mean, I don't quite know how to... So it was a new experience for me to bring people with me that I then was watching out for. Because now my feet are a little more on the ground there. And I know my way around a little more. And there were even more people. The large room that all the women were in is no longer used because it's not anywhere near big enough. And the women now meet in a much larger area that's been enclosed outdoors. And there were easily 10,000 women. And a new building has been built. It's probably finished by now for the men, off a little ways away, just been built in the last few years. And it was not yet finished. I've seen pictures of the inside. There was not room for everyone there. For the men, there was not enough room. So this is something that's very alive. You know, we talk about the Sufis of the past, the great Sufis of the past, and they write, you know, we have their traces, right? But perhaps something that you can take from this conversation is that this is true now, here, and a very alive, living, evolving, changing reality. And our sheikh addresses that the world has changed, and that the methods now are the methods for now. And he's drawing many, 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 many young people and professional people and people of all classes coming together. And people meet in their, you know, in all the cities there's meetings, you know, regular meetings. I went to a meeting in someone's home, and of course the meetings are just for the women. Just beautiful. Mothers and daughters, grandmothers and mothers and daughters come, and we spend the afternoon together reading Quran, praying, and doing the group dhikr that is done. And then there's always lots of mint tea, sweet tea, and cookies, or perhaps a meal afterwards. And I can sense from the friendships and just from the conversations I've had with some of these women that it's not that different than us, you know? Our lives are difficult. Their lives are difficult. And they come and get nourishment. It's real nourishment, this companionship, this time of devotion, this time of prayer, of inspiration, of light, of joy. You get filled up, but I could see it, and we had some conversations, so we just say, you know, life is difficult, but I have the remembrance to keep me connected to what's true, what's real.
You had spoken about how when you came back from meeting your Sheikh Sidi Hamza, you were back to dealing with the everyday grind and, you know, coming home from work and, you know, a little grumpy and washing the dishes and whatnot. I was wondering if you could speak a little more about how your experience with your Sheikh and has helped you to deal with the day-to-day grind.
So again, for me, I think there's several, maybe at least two elements to this. One is when I'd always heard, you know, there's a link with the Sheikh, but I'd never had a living Sheikh, you know, that I was able to, in this embodiment, be together with. It was just not my experience. I thought, maybe never in this lifetime. But something did take place there, and that continues. And I don't know that I could really explain that, but perhaps you can catch a fragrance of that, you know. When we're together, we see each other and we meet our Sheikhs. You know, something is, there's a transmission. So that itself is a help. And then I have my remedy. And that remedy keeps working, not just in the time that I do it, but it keeps working. So throughout the day, the remembrance becomes conscious throughout the day. So it's as though there's the actual experience of being here and here or there. Reality is quite different than I thought or than we think, or, you know, there's something else. And so that something else comes into life somehow. Something gets set in motion. And that's, it feels like this setting in motion, this rhythm, this la 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 la. And when I can relax in my day, it's as though it becomes very easy. Something becomes very easy. So my prayer is that God keeps me, my prayer is that God keeps us in remembrance, because it's those moments of remembrance that then there's no effort. There's no struggle. It can be quite painful. There can be difficulties. It's not like, but there's, and my life is not without its challenges. And I imagine there will be more opportunities. We'll have a choice to say yes or no. But there is. Does that connect? Yeah. Good. Okay. Great. All right. Thank you. Thank you for that question. Hazrat Inayat Khan wrote, or spoke, about Hafiz. I found something that he had said about Hafiz recently, where he said, you know, Hafiz really wrote about God here, about the embodiment of God. You know, there's the transcendence, and then there's the presence, the immanence. And to me, this poem really speaks to the presence of God here on earth, in our lives, in washing the dishes. Here, soar, not with wings, but with your moving hands and feet and sweating brows, standing by your beloved's side, reaching out to comfort this world with your cup of solace, drawn from your vast reservoir of truth, here, sore. Not with your eyes and senses that turn their backs on the earth's sweet stumbling dance, which needs you. Here, love. Oh, here, love. With your mouth tender and open upon your love. And with your heart on duty to the souls of rivers, children, forest animals, all the shy feathered ones and laughing, jumping, shining fish. Oh, here, pilgrim, love, on this holy battleground of life, where there are bleeding ones who are calling for a sacred drink, a gentle word or touch from human or God. Hafiz? Why just serve and play with angels? They are already content. Hafiz, leave your recipes in golden drums. Tie those barrels to the backs of camels who will keep circumambulating the worlds, giving nourishment to all our tender, wondrous spheres. Oh, here, love. Oh, right here. Find your happiness, dear wayfarer, with your beautiful lips and body so sweetly opened, yielding their vital gifts upon this magnificent earth. So let's take a moment. If you have a prayer to offer in your heart, please do. O Allah, beloved one, you who know our hearts and our deepest longings, hear our prayers and answer our prayers through your deep wisdom and mercy and compassion. Amen. So thank you, dear ones, very much for listening on this journey and participating with your beautiful hearts.